Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Many of us in today's America feel that our civil rights are under siege. History has shown us that freedom, even in a country that is still seen by many as a beacon to the world, is fragile. The American Civil Liberties Union is at the front lines protecting those freedoms, but its mission is often misunderstood. The ACLU is preparing a community symposium on our rights and how to protect them. Kit Grant is Deputy Director of the ACLU of Hawaii, and she's with us in our studio. Good morning, Kit.
Hi, Chris. Really nice to be here. Thank you so much.
It's good to have you here. I have to say, I think that in the minds of many in America, the ACLU is somewhat misunderstood. Do you agree?
You know, in some ways, the ACLU is more visible now than we have been before, and mm-hmm. I think a lot of that has to do with the context of the times, you know, that we have a president who campaigned on unconstitutional promises, who's now trying to turn those into unconstitutional policy. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot of folks who are maybe newer to what the ACLU does, but also hopeful that we can help, you know, act as a firebreak to some of these, literal attacks on things like immigration, women's rights, free speech, etc. At the same time, sometimes the work that we do has a controversial aspect, and when we defend, for instance, the free speech of people with wildly unpopular ideas, sometimes people conflate that with us supporting the message. And the fact is that if we don't operate in a fairly content neutral way, I mean, mm-hmm. we can have an opinion about and also be working against the issue that someone is speaking about. But we believe that it's really important that everyone
that they speak
has their say, has their ability to speak, and that the government is not shutting anybody down. So in that sense, sometimes it can get a little like a juggling act.
Yeah,
you know, like which hat are we wearing? Is it our racial justice hat? Is it our free speech hat? But we believe that we can wear both of those hats at the same time, and that it's important. The core fundamental reason why we protect free speech, which is probably some of the most controversial territory that we get into, is the core. It's literally the core of our mission. It's first for a reason.
We might not like the fact that a neo-Nazi or a white supremacist wants to speak, but he or she has a right to.
It's absolutely abhorrent speech, but when you let the government get into the business of determining who can speak, when, for how long, how loudly, where, then eventually those limitations will apply to speech that you do like. And that's why it's important to us to make sure that we are that firebreak. We're the rock on which the water breaks.
A lot of countries lose the rights that their people have and lose them somewhat voluntarily, or lose them by virtue of elections, by virtue of choices made by the people themselves. Why would people give up rights? And then yet it happens, right?
It's a head scratcher. So I think the two areas where that come to mind when we talk about this are free speech and also privacy. Mm-hmm. The ACLU is also like a big, you know, privacy advocate, and we work against government surveillance. And what we find is that sometimes people have these ideas that somehow their free speech will be protected even if they're shutting down someone else's free speech, which is definitely not historically been the case. But also with regards to privacy, people feel that they're so exposed in this modern world, and the government has so many secret back doors and tracking devices, and the police are even locally often using surveillance technology without any oversight by us, that I think you get a little weary, like beaten down, like you think, well, there is no privacy, therefore I don't need to worry about privacy. Mm-hmm. So there can be that kind of fatigue aspect of it, I mm-hmm. think. And also then there can be this just gut reaction to the obnoxiousness of someone else's speech and saying, like, you should really not be able to say that mm-hmm. out loud. And so between those things, I think, you know, sometimes people are willing. We gave up a lot, you know, with the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
That, you know, some of those provisions have just sunsetted. For instance, the government had the ability to get your everything you loaned out at your local library was expected to be turned over to the government without a warrant. Your ISP or your internet service provider, mm-hmm. If they got one of these, like what they called, NSL warrant, mm-hmm. They weren't allowed to tell you that the government was subpoenaing all of your the IP addresses you visited, the websites you visited, etc. So we challenged these things in court with some brave librarians and some brave ISPs, and we managed to get those modified, and then eventually they sunsetted. But these are the types of attacks that are occurring, and it's usually a response to fear.
Yeah, I was going to say a response to some threat, and that's how you give up your rights.
Yeah.
We're in danger, national security, time for us to, you know, cool the free speech for a while.
Yeah.
And then you never get it back.
And that's not, you know, the thing is that it's not unconstitutional or without precedent for the government to curtail some rights in the course of an emergency. Organizations like the ACLU, though, are very watchful to make sure that these are extremely narrowly tailored and, mm-hmm. and that they have a short time span, as short as humanly possible.
How does one educate the community? How does the ACLU go about reaching people and you know, clarifying its message, clarifying to people what their rights are, how to get them, how to protect them?
So, you know, like all organizations, we have a pretty broad online presence, but we also feel that a lot of times the best way to learn about your rights and to strengthen them is to really, like, talk about them, like, kick the tires on these ideas of free speech, of, you know, of privacy, of, you know, how do we envision our policing to work? How does our community want jail and parole and bail to work? How does our society and our community want Hawaii to be welcoming to immigrants and refugees?
Yeah.
These are some of they're heavy questions, you know, and they really don't lend themselves so well to sound bites. And sometimes we convene things like our civil liberties symposiums to really just get people together to, you know, we'll have a few experts there, but we're not there to lecture. Like, we're really there to listen, like, mm-hmm. what's going on in your community, Hilo, about immigration, what's going on in your community, Honolulu, about like building a new jail and getting a new police chief. You know, how can we build civil liberties into these changes that are happening around us and into our communities?
One of the things that you folks have pointed out is that crime rates are going down and incarceration is staying the same, even going up? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, crime rates are at historic lows. And we just keep locking up more and more people. And it's not sustainable. We have actually a complaint in with the Department of Justice over the abhorrent, highly overcrowded conditions in all of Hawaii's jails and prisons.
With what anticipated results? I mean,
this is something that's been going. It's sort of like a pendulum that swings back and forth, usually ending up with us having to file a lawsuit, and then the state being under federal guardianship for a while, and then cleaning up its act, and then it gets worse again. So we're hoping to try to break that cycle. We've seen it happen over the last 30 years, up and down, boom and bust, spear case. There's a bunch of cases. But we're hoping that if we change how we think about incarceration, we could break that cycle.
Usually takes a change in consciousness, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes, group consciousness, yes.
Thanks very much, Kit. Mm-hmm. Kit Grant is Deputy Director of the ACLU of Hawaii. She's been on staff since 2006. The organization is hosting a couple of civil liberties symposia, first on October 7th at 1 p.m. at the UH Hilo campus, then on October 28th at the Blaisdell Center, starting at noon.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
We're back with the conversation from Pledge 2017, Fall 2017, and back with the conversation. The Girl Scouts of Hawaii have been around for 100 years. Hawaii was one of the first states to start a scouting program. Every 2 years, it issues a State of Girls report, and this year's report comes to some troubling conclusions. Girls lag behind in science and math education. More than 1 in 10 says she doesn't feel safe in school. In a survey of girls' overall well-being, Hawaii ranked in the middle, and that's not good enough for Girl Scouts of Hawaii CEO Sherry Chang, who spoke with us about the State of Girls 2017.
This is a report that's updated every 2 years nationally, just so you know, and then each state has their own data that they can take a look at. So for Hawaii, the disturbing thing is that we're only ranked 23rd in the nation for the well-being of young girls from kindergarten to 12th grade.
Yeah.
And they look at all different levels, you know, demographic, health, education, environment, et cetera. And so for us to be rated so low is really disturbing. But part of it has to do with education. When you look at some of the statistics that show that 68% of fourth grade girls aren't proficient in reading, 68% of seventh grade girls aren't proficient in math, and even 11% of girls in Hawaii stated that they didn't always feel safe at school. So those are really troubling statistics. And so it's important that we have programs where the girls learn to develop confidence and character and advocate for themselves as well as for others and kind of find their voice. And that's what the Girl Scout Leadership Program is all about.
It's really surprising that there are so many dynamics in society moving them in the other direction.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. And that's why, you know, we have our outreach programs on Title I schools and under-resourced areas. We even have Girl Scout troops and Boys and Girls Clubs in Nanakuli and Waianae, Ma'ili, places like that, because you know, a lot of these kids, the after-school program, there are no after-school programs at their schools anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, these are pretty under-resourced areas. And so we bring in a program where these girls can be a part of it. You know, money, they don't have to worry about the money part because we fund, you know, the activities, their uniforms, everything. We do get a commitment from the family of $30 for an entire year. And that's just to make the commitment to make sure the girls do attend the meetings and everything. And it's been a really positive thing. We've had some homeless girls that have participated. And one really remarkable story on Maui where a homeless girl, the counselor had asked us to, could we put her in that program, our after-school leadership program, because she wasn't talking. She had no friends. By the end of the school year, she was not only actively involved in school, doing well in school, but she actually even did a community service project for the homeless. Mm-hmm. The family went missing at the end of the school year, so you know everybody was concerned because you know that's unfortunately what does happen. And I was very fortunate that I had worked with the Maui Rotary, and they gave us additional funds to expand that program to 2 more Title I schools on Maui. First day of school the following fall, in walks Madeline and with her uniform on and feeling very proud to be a part of the program still. So she's in her third year with us now. And we have a lot of really nice stories like that, that, you know, may seem like one little girl at a time, but you know you've changed that girl's life.
One is plenty, you know.
Right.
And the whole, there's a real human need to belong to something, to be with like-minded.
Right.
To have friends, right? To have support.
Right.
And that's a place you can go.
And a place where you can learn things and fail but not feel ridiculed or teased. You know, you fall down, you fall down with your sisters and they laugh with you, not at you. And that's kind of the really important part of the camaraderie that Girl Scouts tries to foster is, you know, anti-bullying, anti-mean girl streaks, you know, be supportive of each other and help each other out.
The whole mean girls phenomenon, have you got a handle on what makes it happen?
You know, what surprised me was to see how early it starts.
Yeah.
One of my workers at another, when I was in the hospitality industry, her daughter in preschool was being kind of harassed by other mean girls. And we're like, this is preschool. What, you know, this isn't innate with them.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's really important to have these programs where we really work with girls to better understand the need to support each other, to succeed together, to, you know, find a way to you know, not need to be a mean girl. I mean, that's just, you know, it's just so unnecessary.
And given the fact that it's not innate, there's only one other explanation, which is that society is pushing
right.
And young girls in that direction.
You know, one parent told me, she said, you know, take a look at some of the shows, even though they might be Disney-oriented and stuff, you know, kids are teasing each other, and it's kind of like, okay, because they're doing it. And and I think that's why when we do our anti-bullying campaigns and everything, we try and really emphasize, you know, you wouldn't want to be treated this way, and you need to treat people how you want to be treated. So, and you see that, and this is one thing we do talk about. One of our Gold Award Girl Scouts did a project on this because she was cyberbullied extremely bad where the police were involved. It was quite a big case. And afterwards, the disturbing thing was that it turned out to be someone she knew very well that was a close friend. She didn't want to go to school. She was humiliated. She just wanted to kind of drop out and everything. But her mom said, hey, you've got a Girl Scout troop backing you. They're going to be there for you. They're your friends, and they'll support you. And so now what she did, she just graduated this last year, but she actually went around and talked about bullying and to schools to over 3,000 kids as part of her Gold Award project to talk to them about, here's the steps you need to take, but find a support group that can help you. Because she goes, if it wasn't for my parents and my Girl Scout troop, it would have been really rough.
The whole idea of popular culture being a force that works actually against you is hard to fathom. But that really does seem as if that's the state of girls today.
It is tough. And as a mother of two girls and a grandmother of one granddaughter, you know, that's why to me it's so important that we mentor young girls at a very, very early age. We've got to start in kindergarten. You can't wait till they're in junior high and high school. You need to start quite early to give them the right values and help them see that supportive network and give them those leadership skills, because we've had a lot of girls too that have been, subjects of abuse. And one of the biggest fears is that someone won't speak about it. And that's one of the things we talk about, the girls. Find your own voice. Advocate for yourself and for others. And that's an important part of the leadership experience.
It's really good for them to be away from boys at some point in their growing up, isn't it?
You know, and the statistics show that it actually is they gain more on the leadership and confidence side when they are away from that environment. And I think we've seen a lot of studies that showed, even at school, you know, teachers tend to call on boys raising their hands more and things like that. So when they're in this all-girl environment, whether they go to a co-ed school or not, it actually helps reinforce the confidence that they have. And when we put them through some of the STEM programs and entrepreneurship programs and outdoor experience programs that we do, they truly do learn to, you know, kind of be a little bit tougher and a little bit stronger and stand up for themselves, which is important.
The whole mission of scouting, it's 100 years in Hawaii, right?
Yes, yes.
It's evolved over those years, hasn't it?
It certainly has. I mean, when scouting first started, even on the mainland in 1912 and in Hawaii in 1917, the idea was to it was a time of war, World War I, and Juliet Lowe felt that women needed to get outside of the home. They needed to build skills to be able to be quite honest, to support themselves, because a lot of their young men were being killed. And she felt that they didn't have any experience outside of the home. So initially, scouting started doing community service projects, actually doing a lot of projects supporting, you know, families that were impacted by the war, helping the hospitals and Red Cross and things. Mm-hmm. But they also started doing the camping and the, you know, stretching themselves and kind of testing them, the limits of what they might have been comfortable with. And that was what was really a lot of fun, I think, about the scouting.
And then fun sort of opens the door to a great many other things.
Right. I mean, today's scouting, very different from even when I was, it's girl-led, which means the troop leader doesn't determine everything. They can help in the early stages guide them a little bit, especially on community service. Otherwise, everything would be for puppies and kittens. But it really is important. The girls decide what community service project they're going to do on, what journey camps they're going to work on together as a project. And it's that fun and cooperative learning experience that makes it a more positive environment for them.
Sherry Chang is Chief Executive Officer of Girl Scouts of Hawaii. She most recently launched a campaign for Girl Scouts, We're More Than Just Cookies.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
Several years after the Hawaii Board of Education adopted a new framework of teaching social studies known as C3, short for College, Career, and Civic Ed. Some teachers are showing by their example what this approach looks like on the ground through community-based projects. Joining us for today's reality check is reporter Suvan Lee. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I had social studies back in school, which is quite a while ago, and it was not like this. It was, in fact, you know, somebody up in front of the classroom droning on and the kids trying to stay awake. The traditional model of education, in other words.
Sure. I think we can all remember our social studies classes back in the day, myself included, where it was quite textbook-based.
Was it that way for you as well?
It was.
This is you know, the problem with textbook-based learning and that kind of I talk, you listen type of learning is that you don't necessarily see how it applies to you, right?
Absolutely. And we live in this this era right now where students are have the opportunity to really engage with the communities in which they live. So I think that's what teachers here in Hawaii are aiming to do.
You know, I love that you cite an example of a skateboard park as being used as an example of civic engagement in classes. Tell me about that a little bit.
Sure. So this teacher I spoke with out on Maui, he teaches social studies at Lahaina Luna High School. He was telling me about a real-world example in which he inspired his students to go take action because of a very everyday situation they were dealing with, and that was this issue of skateboarding around the neighborhood. They were called out by the cops, I suppose, mm-hmm. who didn't appreciate the fact that they were taking up sidewalk and street space. So this teacher proposed that they use this as a classroom project to write to a Maui County Council member to go testify and propose a community neighborhood skate park, one of which had never existed in that area before. Mm-hmm. And so here's an example where the teacher and the kids were inspired to take action, and lo and behold, a new skate park was built in the next couple of years, according to what this teacher told me. So there you go. There is chance for change.
Well, that's, you know, when they taught civics way back in the day, that was the whole idea, letting people know that you can get something done in this country, right?
Absolutely. And the C3 framework, which really is what the story kind of revolves around, community, college, and civic education, it's not this newfangled concept. I mean, according to one of the education leaders, these ideas, these concepts of democracy in action have been around. It's just kind of a new set of standards that nationally is being phased out and that states around the country are really adopting and bringing into their own classroom. So it's encouraging that Hawaii has embraced this new pedagogy and that they're starting to train future teachers of tomorrow to learn this and adopt this approach in their classrooms.
And as you said, Suvan, it's kind of ironic that such old ideas are presented as the new thing, right?
Well, I think nothing ever stays irrelevant for too long. So we'll have to see what happens. But it seems to be a good step in the right direction.
It certainly does. Thanks very much for that story.
You bet. Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Suvan Lee.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
A new generation of companies like Uber and Airbnb has come along to rethink the way business is done, and the effects of their disruption are only now beginning to be felt. Airbnb has certainly upended the hospitality industry. Now a new startup is looking to build on that phenomenon by offering down payments to home buyers who pledge to Airbnb a spare bedroom for 12 to 36 months. Yifan Zhang is the CEO and co-founder of Loftium, and she joins us by phone. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, thanks for joining us. This is a pretty intriguing idea. How'd you come up with it?
So the idea behind Loftium was actually based on my own personal experience buying my first home in Seattle and renting out the extra bedroom at Airbnb.
Uh-huh.
One bedroom at Airbnb was enough to cover my entire mortgage for my three-bedroom townhouse. So that, in conjunction with all the complaints I heard from my friends around the down payment, I kind of put those two ideas together to use Airbnb income as a means of paying for that down payment to help people get into their first home.
That's a pretty appealing idea, because what you're talking, if you can get an Airbnb to pay for your mortgage, what you're talking about is practically a free house if you're willing to be a landlord for, what, 3 years?
Yep, 1 to 3 years. It's definitely a decision that you shouldn't take lightly. You do have to sacrifice a little bit of time and kind of that personal privacy for 12 to 36 months. But then at the end of it, you know, this is not a loan. You don't have to pay us back the down payment. The house is yours.
What do you get out of it? What's your income stream?
So Loftium actually predicts how much Airbnb income a single bedroom can generate. And we build in the cost of our operations as well as the profit margin before giving out the down payment up front. So all of our revenue is paid just through the Airbnb income.
But you need to, so if I've got a room in my house that I want to rent out, I've got to, I split that with you. You get a percentage of that.
Exactly. Yep. So during the 12 to 36 months, not only do you get the upfront down payment that you don't have to pay us back, you also get a certain percentage of the monthly income. And that's really important because for first-time home buyers, you know, the monthly mortgage sometimes is a little bit more than they were paying for rent. So it's really helpful to get that split of Airbnb income.
So chances are you're not going to be doing it this way with Loftium. You're not likely to get your mortgage paid by you. By the time you split it with Loftium, you're not going to be able to pay your mortgage with that. You'd have to charge way too much, yeah?
Not during the 12 to 36 months.
Yeah.
But like I mentioned, at the end of the contract, right, your home is yours, that room is yours, so you can decide if you want to continue Airbnb-ing it or if you want to just use it for your own personal use.
You know, I've just recently been looking at that website, and it's very robust. You get a lot of detail about the houses. There's a map of houses, and you can go to any town, find out where the Airbnbs are. You can get in touch with the owner, et cetera. It's really almost like going to a hotel in a sense. You can process your credit card, make the payment in advance, all that. So that system, is a pretty stable one. And are you going to sort of construct your site the same way? I mean, how do you sort of dovetail with Airbnb? And do you have any kind of relationship with that company specifically?
Yeah, we don't have a formal partnership with Airbnb, but we do use the platform just like anyone else. So the website, Airbnb's website, is really great. So I'm actually a host myself. I've actually hosted over 200 guests in my extra bedroom. And it's such a great experience. It's really easy for guests. And Loftium actually is added as a co-host to the Airbnb account so that we can help out with some things like the pricing strategy, the messaging of guests, to make lives easier for our home buyers.
In your experience as a landlord, how was that learning curve? By now, you know it pretty well, having done 200 people. But how tough was it to become a landlady, if you will?
Yeah, it's a lot easier, I think. The fact that it's my primary home, I'm living on premise, I'm renting out the extra bedroom. So Airbnb kind of sets the structure, the legal structure, basically. So I don't have to do any tenant leases or anything. The guests book directly from the platform. And I've actually automated a lot of my own processes. Down to kind of around 15 minutes a week is how much time I spend managing the Airbnb. So that's our goal at Loftium, too. We're trying to set up all the structures and automation so that this is more of a passive income stream experience instead of an active, you know, management.
I could tell from the way you're expressing yourself that you've grown up knowing the language of the Internet, knowing the very contemporary language of communications. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Yeah, knowing how to use and exploit the methods of communication. Because, you know, at the beginning of this interview, I referred to Uber and Airbnb and companies of that kind as disruptive. In a sense, they are, yeah?
Yeah, I think they are. So I think Airbnb especially, it's disruptive to the hotel industry. But I think it's pretty helpful for the travelers that use it and also for the hosts that use it for the extra income stream.
Yeah.
So my husband and I are both entrepreneurs. You know, we don't have kind of the most stable lifestyle, but Airbnb kind of helps us smooth that out and gives us the security to actually become homeowners in an expensive city like Seattle. So hopefully we can kind of spread that to more people.
So you're firmly placing yourself within this kind of new economy that Airbnb represents. I mean, you're now part of a whole new way of rethinking business, is way it looks to me.
Yeah, I think we are. And I think it's slightly different because with Airbnb and with Lofty's down payments, we're not trying to replace anyone's jobs. You do still have to have your normal income to be able to support the mortgage. But what we're trying to do is just add an extra income stream. And it's really helpful, especially if you are, you know, middle class, middle income, and living in expensive cities, having that just extra cushion really makes people feel more secure.
You know, one of the challenges I would think you would face getting off the ground is that putting out a lot of down payments is pretty capital intensive, and that the money is not going to come in that fast, or is it? How quickly can
right.
you get repaid for your investment?
Yeah, so because our contracts are relatively short, you know, it's only 12 to 36 months,
mm-hmm.
We do get paid back fairly quickly compared to, say, a 30-year mortgage.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But that that being said, we definitely had to raise funding to kind of start this program, and that's why right now we're only available in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
But we're hoping to add more markets quickly. We've just seen such an overwhelming demand for Lofty's down payments in the first week and a half even, that, you know, we're definitely pretty excited.
The 12 to 36 month arrangement, I assume you get a smaller down payment or less of a down payment if you do 12 rather than 36 months?
Yes. For the most part, but it also depends on kind of what type of home you're looking to buy and what neighborhood. So there are certain neighborhoods that have great Airbnb income, so sometimes you can even get a 12-month contract and still have a really large down payment. One of our first customers was in that situation. She bought a small mother kind of home with a mother-in-law unit underneath the main house,
mm-hmm.
in a great neighborhood in Seattle, and was able to just have a 12-month contract to cover that down payment need.
I think a lot of people are kind of picking up their ears to hear this, Yvonne. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're trying to just open up people's eyes to different ways of thinking about homeownership. You don't have to just save up 20% over 10 years. You know, you can actually become a homeowner today and, you know, work towards building that passive income stream.
Well, good luck to you. Thanks very much for talking with us. Yifan Zhang is the CEO and co-founder of Lofty's, a venture-funded startup that gives you a down payment on a new home if you Airbnb a spare bedroom for 12 to 36 months. They're operating right now in Seattle. You can learn more about it on our Facebook page, The Conversation. And now back to Wayne Yoshioka at Pledge Central.